This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we're going to feature interviews that were collected, conducted by Ryan Fairfield and myself, Tony Lupo, for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. The focus of this podcast is not going to be on world leaders or events that led to World War II. It's not going to be about general strategy. It's going to be about the everyday GI soldiers and their experience. Welcome to our journey.
All right. Welcome to the Warrior Next Door podcast. I'm Ryan Fairfield.
And I'm Tony Lupo.
And this is episode 4 of 4 in this four-part series on Mr. Allen Sr.'s World War II experiences as a B-24 waste gunner. So far, we've heard about his training, his enlistment, his travel overseas, and his harrowing experiences that he had as a B-24 waste gunner in the European theater. So in this episode, we're going to be covering more about how he transitioned to civilian life after the war and really getting him into a lot of his recollections and what he has learned looking back on his military service. Okay, so what we're going to do now, we'll move on to, Alan just kind of reflecting a bit on his unit's heritage. He talks about here what he had to go through. And as we just described, for us, it's pretty harrowing stuff. But then he kind of draws a conclusion later that, what he's been going through really wasn't as bad as what previous guys have gone through.
We had it very easy compared to the men who went over in 43 and 42. They were writing the book as they went along there. Our group went over in 43 and had one of the best safety records of any group. And that was partly due, and greatly due, to the tight formations we flew. And as a tribute to that, that our group was chosen to lead the 8th Air Force on D-Day because of bombing accuracy and known for our on-time performance, which means that we were formed and ready to go at the proper time and reach the rendezvous point at the proper time. And it's a tribute to the crews at that time that we did that.
Well, that's quite an honor. The largest invasion in a European, in world history up to that point. And they're asked to be the tip of the spear. It makes one wonder why that mattered. Well, these guys weren't just blowing up bridges and towns at this point. This would have been tactical air raids. This would have been softening up defensive positions with human beings in them, hopefully Germans, so that when our boys landed on shore, they'd have an easier time of it.
All right. In this next segment here, we're going to spend a little bit of time just kind of letting Al talk about some of the stuff they did while they were in their downtime while stationed over in England.
Oh, if I've got time, I'd like to just tell you a story. And it's another coincidence. When I was in, about the 10th grade, the English teacher said that we need to get pen pals. So I got a pen pal of a girl from England. So we corresponded back and forth, and I told her that with the war, I might come over to England. You know, I might be over there in the Air Force. And way it came about, I did. I went to meet her. She lived in Todmorden, which is up near Manchester in the industrial section. And her name was Florence Britton, if you can believe that.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the pen pal side of this. This is something maybe certain contemporary viewers may not have remembered if they're not older like we are, but back before social media, back before the internet, when you could basically communicate with anyone you want, anywhere in the world, anytime, in any language, you had to write letters to people. And one way that people who couldn't afford to travel, and obviously there wasn't anything like the internet, was to have pen pals, was to have letters that you would write to complete strangers and get to know them. And they could be anywhere in the world. And the reason why Al calls this a coincidence or a highly improbable event is, you know, what are the odds that he'd have a pen pal in Britain near the place where he was stationed, mention something about, hey, I could end up being over there and meeting you during the war, because we could be in a war at some point and you know, and be involved in that, and then have it happen and actually meet her. I think a lot of the magic could be lost on a modern audience.
Mm-hmm.
You have to bring yourself back to this time to really appreciate, you know, how cool it was that, you know, all these connections were made for him to meet this person he corresponded with, and then to develop a in-person relationship with or friendship with her and their family,
mm-hmm.
that lasted after the war.
Yeah, and he speaks about, you know, how he was kind of a novelty over there, you know, and how her parents would introduce him to their friends as, you know, Florence's American friend, you know.
Right.
And so he was like, he felt a bit like a rock star, I think, you know. So it's pretty interesting to hear him talk about that.
Yep. Okay, so in his next clip, Al's going to describe another situation off base during downtime that didn't quite go as swimmingly as that of his pen pal.
In fact, I got in a taxi, another crew member and myself, and there were two Americans in there. And they got after us. They said, "You damn guys bombed us." And they named some city. And I said, "Well, it's really hard to tell at 20-some thousand feet who's down there. And your leaders, your officers, should have been in touch with the Allies to tell them, don't bomb here. You fellows did a great job. We moved so fast, and when we had our orders, we dropped the bombs there when we're as ordered." So needless to say, we were glad to get out of the taxi. I don't think they really bought my story very well.
Yeah, so I think he did a great job of diffusing that situation, no pun intended, you know, with his previous stories he talked about. But, you know, you think about this, you know, the coordination, you know, back at this time, you know, 80 years ago, where, you know, you had guys on the ground, you had guys in the air. At this point in the war, they're moving fast, mm-hmm. because things are collapsing on the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, the German army is collapsing. The intelligence that his group has, if it's a day old, could be very wrong.
And this is, remember, there's no GPS, there's no satellite phones, there's no friendly forces recognition flags that you can wear on your helmet. And like you said, this was a very dynamic battlefield, especially at this point of the war. Things were not stagnant at all. And really what was interesting about this clip is we hear and read a lot about friendly fire incidences, even in modern warfare, because it's seen as, well, they call it fratricide.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds horrible, right? I mean, it's probably the worst way to die in a war is to be killed by your own side. And so we've heard other stories from other soldiers on the ground who just wanted to go strangle these quote-unquote flyboys. And it's good to get the flyboys' perspective to let them know, you know, hey, these are some of the variables that we have to deal with. And, you know, and it happens.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so we'll move on to the next segment here. This is right after VE Day. He's going to be talking about VE Day here and everything, but... and then he gets to go on a what you would call a joyride or a tourist ride in the B-24 right after, like the day after VE Day.
Well, an interesting sidelight to that, on the war ended, I think, on May 8th. And May 9th, we were allowed to make a tourist flight, I guess you would say. We flew to Germany and some of the bombed out cities at maybe 1,000 feet. We flew down the Rhine River and I could look out my waist window and I didn't see any sky. I just saw the bank of the Rhine River. We were that low. But it was so interesting. I just wish I'd had a video camera or could take in some pictures, because there's so much you're seeing that you can't assimilate it all. But it was wonderful. We saw planes that had been forced landing. We saw where there had been tracks of big tank fights, trenches, and the devastation of the German cities were terrible, just terrible.
So here's what Al saw. When they were doing their low-level flight after the war, they were witnessing a battlefield that was barely a month old. It was about two and a half weeks old. It was the last major battle on the Western Front, the last major encirclement that the Allies were able to impose on the German army. And it was an offensive that started basically April 1st, 1945. And by April 15th, by the middle of April, the German 15th Army, which had been surrounded and was commanded by Field Marshal Model, it was clear they weren't going to make it. The pocket included the towns of Dusseldorf, Essen, and Dortmund, for those who have a map in front of you. And it was so dire. And of course, you had the typical thing that was going on during the war, where Model, who was a field marshal, knew that the jig was up, wanted to surrender peacefully, wanted to preserve lives. And Russia was going to, not Russia, but Hitler was calling this, you need to treat each position like a fortress. You will fight to the last man. And heroically, what Model did was he took all the Volkssturm, which were these citizen troops, these people who weren't fit for service earlier in the war. And as times got desperate, they ended up taking them anyway, training them oftentimes with second-rate weapons and using them in stopgap measures. Most of this force was made up of the Volkssturm. And what Model did, he said, take off your uniforms and go home. You know, just leave. Even with those individuals who left, there were still 317,000 German troops that surrendered in this last cauldron, including 24 generals. Now, Model wouldn't be among those generals. A few weeks after issuing that order for basically allowing his men to leave the army, he committed suicide. Mm. And they didn't just, the Allies didn't just eliminate an army. They also freed hundreds of thousands of prisoners of war, Russians in particular. They ran into concentration camps, slave labor camps, where people were underfed, diseased, and malnourished. So what Al saw, the reason I think he wanted to have the camera, is he was watching a freshly blackened piece of scorched earth that was literally the last violent death throes of the German Wehrmacht in the West.
It had to be just a spectacular sight, as he described. I mean, it had to be rich with detail and just seeing the tank tracks and, like you said, where the planes force landed and everything. It had to be fascinating to view.
Yeah. So this concludes the portion of the interviews where he's in country fighting battles. Now we're going to talk about what happened after the war. VE Day has happened. He cycled out of the military, and he has a really interesting story about how he's able to enjoy starting civilian life.
In December, and I remembered walking, I had my barracks bag and headed down towards the train station, and I walked past, I think it was a restaurant, and they were playing I'll Be Home for Christmas, and sure enough, I was.
Now, a lot of GIs were hoping they were going to be home for Christmas in 1944, not 1945. But nevertheless, he was, and it must have been a good feeling to have flown his 10 missions, did his job. And there's a couple other clips that we want to pull out where he talks about transitioning to civilian life. And the next one is on something called the GI Bill, which still exists today, but it was started in World War II to help returning veterans, millions of them, resettle, retool, retrain in a civilian life. And so here's Al's comments on that program.
Did you receive the benefits from the GI Bill and go back to school?
Yes. And that was a great benefit, and I think also for our country, because it raised the educational level of the average man, woman in the street several notches over it would have been. I was the first part of my my family to go to college and graduate. My dad went to the ninth grade. My mother finished high school and was a rural teacher for one semester, I think. So I think that was one of the great things that happened was the GI Bill.
So in a world where everyone is told that they need to go to college, be successful, that was not the case previous in history, even in the 80s and 90s. It's more of a recent phenomenon. But, you know, back then, as he mentioned, and that's why we put this in this clip, I mean, his dad only made it through ninth grade, and there's a lot of veterans that we interviewed who didn't even make it through the ninth grade.
True.
And to go from that sort of agrarian, rural type of education to one where they're going to these cities with these large universities that's being paid for by the American government, by the taxpayers, to help retrain these men and women. It was amazing. It was a significant seismic shift in how our workforce was educated. It's an amazing program and still exists today. If you're a vet who is listening to this podcast and you had a chance to enjoy the benefits of the GI Bill, you can thank the administration and the veterans who clamored for these sort of benefits when they got home. The last thing you want to do is have 12 million men who aren't trained to do the things that need to be done, that, you know, can't start families, can't go to work. It was definitely not a waste of taxpayers' dollars. I strongly support the program.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, so this clip now is talking about friends he made after the war, basically staying in touch with his crew and the relationship he had with the pilot and his grandson, actually. Mm-hmm.
But the pilot and I got along very well, and we have had a relationship after the war until he passed on. And one interesting factor about that, his grandson never knew his grandfather. And so he wanted to learn more about what his grandfather did in the war. And he was smart enough to figure out how to do that. He went ahead and, on an internet site, he got an English email address. And this is luck. He went ahead and emailed this individual over there wanting to know, do you know Alan Sr.? He was with Bob Drake's crew and etc. And he, out of all the people he could have had to see his email, was an English man who I'd met in England, and he and his wife had come over and visited our house here.
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, there's a lot of things that I think Tony and I have experienced while we've been on this journey of interviewing veterans. And it's these strange coincidences that happen, and it stops and gives you pause. You know, what I love about this clip is that the grandson of this guy, this pilot, the grandson never knew the grandfather who was the pilot, takes it upon himself to learn a bit more about his family's history. And through sheer luck, links up with Alan with one degree of separation between them, you know? And it's those sorts of things give you goosebumps, you know? I mean, I've got stories I'll share at some point down the road of my own journey researching my uncle, who I never knew, who was killed in Vietnam, and how I got in touch with his veteran friends and have great friendships today. Tony's got stories. But this stuff happens, very common, it seems like. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I think one of the more profound things that I've experienced on this journey of interviewing veterans and And it's more than just the interview with the veterans. They're letting you into their homes. Oftentimes their family members are there. Sometimes they are grandsons. Oftentimes they're sons and daughters. Sometimes some certain family members do not want to be there, and they are deliberately separated in the room. It's deeply personal. You're bringing up memories of things. And the thing that I find most profound about this is when you do have these coincidences, these things that people tell you about that are highly improbable events, and they really make you think philosophically about what we're doing and philosophically about human connections and how and why they're made. And as we move forward with additional interviews, you're going to see this as a theme, and it's not one we had to make up or contrive. It's one that reared its head enough that we could no longer ignore it. It's a thing.
Yeah, agreed.
And he said, he wrote back and said, of course I know Alan Sr. Here's his address. Here's his telephone number. And that young man, Michael Anthony, I'm his surrogate grandfather, I guess. But it just made me feel good that I could help them connect.
Yeah, that's. I think that's one of the beautiful things that comes out of these sorts of experiences. Obviously, it was a traumatic time in all these guys' lives. It was for many of these guys, the pinnacle of their reason for being in their life. Specifically, with the World War II generation, this, you know, the fact that they were able to participate in this great effort, protect their nation and their way of life, and as it turns out, liberate, you know, millions of people from an oppressive regime on both sides of the world. But being able to for him, he's paying back his pilot friend by having a relationship with his grandson. I mean, that's a cosmic sort of connection there.
It is, and the relationships that you and I have developed from interviewing these veterans and getting their family has been profound as well. You got to remember, so early in a podcast, we said that we were volunteers for the Veterans History Project, but we weren't the volunteers in the sense that, like a census volunteer, where you knock on someone's door, you get their information, you leave. We develop long-term relationships with a lot of these individuals. When they let you into their life like that, it's a privilege and it's an honor. And the last thing that you and I wanted to do was to treat them and the interview like just a piece of data, like just a data point. Like we were software people, not hardware people. We wanted to connect with the people. And it's great to see this. And it also goes to show how much they also wanted to participate in this. There's this, I know it's a pretty common narrative about the typical World War II GI not sharing information with people, but oftentimes that's their family for whatever reason. They do open up a bit more when it's not a family member.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening here.
How many times have we interviewed guys and at the end of the, and we didn't know these guys, met them right then and there through certain, you know, we were doing a project where we went to a reunion and we interviewed, we set up a bunch, you know, 15, 20 interviews ahead of time. And it was a conveyor belt of interviewing guys all day long. And some of these guys would, after they sat down with us and, you know, we're a stranger to them, they don't care what we think, you know? So I think that lets them open up a bit more, strangely enough. And they would tell me, I don't know how many times I've had them tell me, you know, I've told you stuff today I've never told anybody before. And I'm not anyone special. I didn't draw it out of him. I think that it was the idea that they were essentially preserving history in a sense. And they wanted to tell their story. These guys were getting older at the time. You know, most all of them that we've interviewed are gone now. But getting back to the relationship part of things, you know, I made great friends interviewing these guys. We had a Christmas card list every year we'd send out, and I had 15 or so veterans that I have a strong relationship with after that point. I call these guys weekly and talk to them. I think now I have one left that I send a card to. And, you know, it's sad, but it's time marches on. And, you know, I would just say for anyone listening, man, just, you know, dig into your own family history, dig into what is, you know, what, how did your parents meet? Do you know that? Find that out. Go talk to your grandma or your grandpa right now while they're still alive. Find out what they did during some pivotal moment in history for your family or for your, in general. We're no one special. We just had an interest to do it. Honestly, I would say this, if it weren't for Tony being a cohort here, I probably wouldn't have done none of this.
Well, and same on my side. I think it took both of us to reinforce our passions in this.
And to spur each other on.
And to spur each other on. And to fill in gaps. There's things that you and I do differently well. I agree. And, you know, you talk about the relationships. I mean, I've had these videotaped interviews that we've done played at wakes and funerals where people have called me up crying saying they felt like he was still there when they had a chance to read it. So not only do we encourage people to sit down with their parents and uncles and aunts and just ask questions, get your face out of your iPad and talk to people. Because I think you will find that through each person, there's some story to tell. There's something that's interesting. And ignoring it in today's culture where everyone is isolating themselves, because of things that have happened with the pandemic and because of what we do with social media, we're encouraging people to go out and talk. So this next clip talks about how when you got home, not everything went well. Not everything was particularly cheery and rosy. There's a particular chapter in Al's life that he's not particularly happy about, and he's going to share it with us right now.
And nothing was more saddening to me than what the Vietnam boys went through. American people should be ashamed of themselves for what they did to those veterans.
Alan got pretty emotional here at this part in the clip. You know, it's amazing. He gets through his entire war story, and it's something that happens 20 years, 30 years later that touches him more than anything. And one of the things I regret looking at this interview now is that we didn't follow up with him on why this emotion bubbled to the surface with him, because he, you know, perhaps it was an experience. Maybe his son, for all we know, might have been a Vietnam veteran, and perhaps he's, you know, dealing with the emotions of what his son maybe went through when he got back. We don't really know. I'm sure that if Mrs. Senior's out there listening to this, she might be able to enlighten us on what it was about Alan's perspective on the way the Vietnam veterans were treated, what's behind that.
Yeah, we know that there's been movies and books and whatnot written about how the Vietnam veterans were treated when they got home, and I agree it was shameful. I was really encouraged to see how much support our more recent vets have received with some of the battlefield conditions that they were faced with, and then coming home and getting more support for PTSD and those sorts of things. But this wasn't uncommon in other interviews we've conducted. And again, we're foreshadowing here. There were other vets who mentioned this. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a fraternity amongst veterans. And I think part of the social contract between civilians and veterans that's not written, is that regardless of win, lose, or draw, when you came home, you still fought for your country. Men sacrificed their lives. Many died or remained. And that the civilian population should support those veterans. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in many cases in Vietnam, that didn't happen.
All right. So now in our closing segment here, just a few minutes and some observations from Alan on just the impact that the whole experience has had on him.
My perseverance to get into the Army, the Air Force. If you want something badly enough, and make a commitment that it can happen. Although I did go on and to be a pilot that I wanted to be, I didn't. The next best thing. Just being a crew member, so I made my donation, my participation. And I think that to me is personally what I'm proud of, and that I did my job as best I could.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this was deeply impactful for Alan, this whole experience. You can tell he's emotional here. You know, it meant the world to him. He's very, you know, proud of his service and proud of his contribution to our country.
Yeah. And, you know, proud, pride, that word has a lot of loaded meaning, in our society, in our culture. I think one of the reasons why a lot of veterans or people generally, you know, don't share certain things about their lives is because they don't want to be seen as prideful or boastful. And there's this fine line between those two. But what we've noticed is that for a lot of people, there's certain things in their lives, if they're fortunate enough, that they participated in, where they have the license to be proud of it without being boastful. And I think World War II for these veterans was that. For other people, it could be something else. I'm not saying yet you have to be in a war to feel this. But for these World War II veterans, it's the thing in their life that they can sit down and tell us about and have a high degree of satisfaction. We have one more clip on this that just kind of sums it up, and we'll have Ryan cue it up right now.
Quite a lot. It's just that it's a most significant part of my life. I'm proud for what I did. I'm not bragging about it, but I'm proud that I was up to do what I had to do.
And that's the end of tape. And with that particular segment, the reason we pulled it out is I want to do a couple of things here. One is obviously, you know, recognize the veterans for the service that they provided, for the hardships they endured, for the things they were pulled into without wanting to be pulled into. No one wanted this war. None of these guys wanted to go over there. But at the same time, we hear Al and others say quite frequently that this was, you know, quote unquote, the most important thing in their lives. I don't want this to diminish things like marriage and family and grandkids and all that. I believe from talking to these veterans, the reason they call World War II and their experiences in it the most important event in their life is so they had the ability to go home and start a family and go to work and get married and have grandkids. That was really the most important thing they wanted to do. But they knew that if they didn't do this thing at that time, that their ability to do those other things that were really, truly important to them, like having a family, may have been impaired in some way.
Well, I think that, you know, them having gone through this crucible and seeing the death and the destruction and the random nature of how people alongside him and other planes could get knocked out of the sky gives you quite a bit of an appreciation for how you're going to live your life when you get back home. And once you get back home, and there's a reason why there was a baby boom after World War II. All these guys got home and they got married and they started having their families and they got busy living.
And baby booms and building booms and technology booms and the whole thing boomed. It was almost like all of this, you know, pent up goodness that wasn't allowed to flourish because we were fighting a war just blew up. And the world that we're living in now is directly linked to that huge growth, that huge shift that happened after World War II. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a proponent of having these world wars, these terrible events, in order for history to continue to advance. We can advance outside of violence. And I think That's another message we get from these World War II veterans, was the waste of war. They didn't want to have to suffer through that again. But at the same time, this watching all this destruction really created the war that we live in, where people had higher, more education, our life expectancy increased, the ability to make wonder drugs like antibiotics became widely available. So those are the sort of things that I think we don't need to heroify and try to raise war up into this noble endeavor, because it's not. But what we can raise to a noble endeavor is how humans like Al reacted to all this waste and destruction to create a life where, you know, hopefully his kids wouldn't have to be subjected to what he was subjected to.
Yeah, I would agree.
So this concludes our inaugural podcast series on Alan Sr. for the Warrior Next Door podcast. And we'd just like to recognize some of the reference material that we used in the making of this podcast. Obviously, the primary source was what you heard from Alan Sr. himself, but we also augmented that with some interesting statistics from John Ellis's book, World War II, A Statistical Survey, The Essential Facts and Figures for All of the Combatants. And that was really helpful in being able to kind of share with you the magnitude of the Allied air might in during World War II. And so that was used for a lot of that portion. Other elements included what, Brian?
Well, so obviously all of these interviews are stored at the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. You can go there to www.loc.gov/vets, and you can search the collection there to your heart's content. Just go in there, search for veteran, and type in Alan Sr., and you can pull his interview up, see what Mr. Sr. looks like, and watch these videos uncut in their entirety.
And lastly, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Oh, we don't have any. That's it. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Sponsors?
Sponsors? You're going to sponsors? Anyway, we hope you enjoyed the journey with us. We've got another podcast series on cue that you think you'll enjoy. So please subscribe to our podcast and tune in for what's next.
So, well, this is going to wrap up this episode. Hey, our first podcast is in the books. The main thing I think that we need to say here in the closing, if you're listening to this and you have an appreciation of history, do yourself a favor, do your family a favor, and go out and document a little bit of it. Talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to that veteran that's next door, that warrior that's next door to you that you see outside flying his flag, you know. Talk to people. Get your nose out of the screens and get out there and interface with these people and press the flesh and talk to them. Anyway, in closing, you've been listening to the Warrior Next Door podcast. I'm Ryan Fairfield.
I'm Tony Lupo, and we'll see you next time.
Well, thanks for joining us. If you like what you hear, please like us at the Warrior Next Door podcast Facebook page. Feel free to post your questions, and we'll try to answer them in the next series of interviews that we do. All of our interviews are archived at the Veterans History Project, Library of Congress, and also with our partner at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.